Hi guys, this is Sue Ludwig, and I can see a couple of you and see a bunch of you online. So just to let you know, if you've never been here before, this is Sue Ludwig, president and founder of NANT, and we are using Zoom now for these calls. So kind of before we get to anything else, you may be on video if you have video capability on your computer. If you do not want to be seen, which I'm happy when I see your faces, just FYI, it's more human, so I can see you there, Emily. And but if for some reason you don't, you can always go to the bottom of your screen and hover, and you can hit stop video if you don't want that on. So I always like to know that myself if I'm on video, how to stop it if I have to go away or something's going on in the background. So the way that this works for Inner Circle Mentoring Call is that this is a special time that we set aside so that you guys can come and ask questions and also listen to what other people's questions are and learn from them and get some feedback in kind of real time. It is only me today, so, and you guys. So this is meant to be not just my feedback, but we have a lot of expertise within the membership. So if you guys have comments or feedback or answers to questions you hear from somebody else, please feel free to raise your hand as well and give feedback. So this isn't just about my replies, it's also about the collective intelligence of this group. This is not, however, substitution for being oriented in the NICU by a mentor. And this is just some guidance that you can get and feedback in real time. So the way this works technically is that we, any of you that are here live that I can see or see on the dashboard, even if you're not on video, you guys get precedence for your questions for kind of showing up live. So the way that you can ask questions are twofold. If you're only on the phone and you're listening, you can hit *9 and the number 9. So *9 will raise your hand and I'll see that your hand's raised. You can raise your hand at any time during the whole call. You do not have to wait for me to cue you because it'll just show up and I'll take you in order. So you're not, no big deal. Just at any time hit *9 to raise your hand. Or on the right side of your screen, you can hit raise my hand, or you can hit and type in the chat window as well. If you're on the computer, you can raise your hand as well by clicking that little button. So we're gonna get started, and we have an hour for this call. We use whatever time up to that hour that we have questions. So might be 30 minutes, 40 minutes, a whole hour, depending on what you guys need. I do have some emailed questions that we'll get to if the live questions are already answered. So any questions, you can hit *9 to raise your hand and I will unmute your line to ask, or you can type them in the chat window if you prefer. It is sometimes nice to just be verbal though, just FYI, because then we can have a conversation versus sometimes I might misinterpret things that are printed. So whatever works for you is great. And thanks, I see a few more of you joining. Fun to see everybody coming in. So I do not currently, and Laura, remind me, they do have the little, they can also click to raise their hand if they're on the computer, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, so anybody who's joining, you can hit *9 to raise your hand. If you're only on the phone, you can click the little button on their screen that says raise my hand or raise hand. And you can also type your questions in the chat window. So those are your three options. If there are no live questions, I'll go to emailed questions, but I want to give you guys a chance to ask first. Sorry about that. So far, I'm not seeing any hands raised. And if for some reason you're raising your hand by one of those ways, and we're not seeing you, feel free to type something in to say, hey, I'm trying to raise my hand. If you're watching me on video, excuse my very casualness today, but I'm headed to a volunteer thing later this afternoon. So I'm in volunteer wear. All right, I'm gonna take the first email question since I don't see any hands raised yet. And that is from Rachel. She said, I have a question about how standardized evals are used in your practices. I know that NANT promotes the use of standardized evaluations, but the problem I'm having is that I am starting a program in a level 3 NICU where they use the Morgan assessment, and the assessment was put into their electronic medical documentation to use as their evaluation. The staff is generally poorly trained and has been overusing this assessment without any clinical reasoning behind what they're seeing and testing for. Additionally, their evaluation write-up has essentially been clicking off boxes and not requiring them to do any interpretation of the results. In this case, I feel the use of a standardized eval has hurt the therapeutic process, and I want to move away from it and have the staff use a more clinical evaluation process so they can better learn how to interpret what they are seeing. However, this seems in conflict with recommendations of NANT, and I'm wondering your thoughts on all of this. So thanks for the background, because again, you can see if you only ask the question, I wouldn't be able to answer it very well without all that background. So thank you for the context, Rachel. So one thing is I want to go back and just address, as far as NANT recommending standardized assessments, I think what I would change about that is that we recommend using standardized assessments when they make sense, when they make sense for the population that you serve, when they make sense for the gestational ages that you are evaluating, and that in my experience, most very experienced clinicians use a handful of ways to assess infants. Some of them are pure observation based on what you know about movement and observation and state and all those things that we can observe. And then also some use of standardized assessments. You might use those in various settings or at various times. So I just want to kind of give you some reassurance, Rachel, that I think whenever we find ourselves saying in practice, I'm not talking like from NANT here, but I'll get to that, that, you know, hey, we always use whatever kind of assessment, whether it be observational or standardized, that we're probably missing a little of the boat in each way. So meaning that I think you have to look at your population, decide as a unit and as a team what you are going to use for evaluations and why. Why does it make sense, to your point, to use this type of evaluation for this type of patient or population? And then just have some guidelines around that for your unit because and for your team. Because I think a lot of the frustration comes from the lack of clarity about like what have you decided as a team and then how do you want to enact those things. So I would say that while NANT has, while at conferences, there have been several, you know, standardized evaluations presented and things, I wouldn't say that's us recommending that we only use those as much as, hey, if you are going to use standardized assessments, which can be very valuable for standardizing how you look at things and how you look at the patient, we would never say all or none. So I hope that's a little validating to you, what you're seeing. As far as it being clicking off boxes, I found this when I was still clinical to be an issue as well. Seeing the transition over a couple decades of writing literal soap notes where you had to write every single thing out and have all your thoughts and the interpretation to kind of click, 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 and making a plan that was often click, click as well. You do sort of start to lose the art of the assessment piece and what you're really seeing. So what I would recommend is if in whatever way your electronic documentation is built, that there is room for and encouragement to have open comments in there so that you can qualify some of your statements, that you can definitely write sort of the outliers to things that you might be clicking or explaining them in more depth. So, you know, maybe I'm old school, but I do like to be able to explain what I'm seeing and not just with a click box. So even if there are several clicks to make it efficient, always having a space where you can write something for your assessment as well, because a lot of things do take explanation and it does continue to develop your own reasoning skills and your own assessment skills to have to interpret what you just saw in a way that you can verbalize back to someone. Because you're not gonna, we know that in the units, not the only form of communication is clicking off boxes. You're gonna see the attending and they're gonna say, what did you think of baby Smith? And you should, you know, if we never say these things or process them in words, we are gonna lose our ability to articulate what we saw and interpret it. So I think it's a valuable skill to keep. And if you can build that into your electronic documentation, great. If you can have options in your electronic documentation for entering observations and using different tools, then fabulous. the documentation people don't like that. They want to have one thing. So how that is enacted in your unit is up to you. But I would use, decide as a team what you want to use, have a rationale for why you're going to use those assessments and when you're going to use them, and then have some space built in where you can explain what you are actually seeing or some added interpretation of the results, for sure. And then it sounds like you have maybe a skill set that you haven't found in every team member, which is great. So meaning that that's an opportunity for you to mentor and really build into that team. And I think sitting down with them all together first and saying, hey, where do we want to go? What do we want to do? Where are the gaps in the knowledge base of the team so far? And how can we start to just slowly fill in the gaps? You know, it takes a lot of work to mentor people, but it will be well worth it in the end. So let me know if you're on this call, because some of them are numbers and not names. So let me know if you have any other comments about that. If you're listening and you have comments about what assessments you're using or how you've solved that problem, you can hit *9 or type in the chat to communicate that. Or you can also raise your hand, of course, if you have a similar related question or a totally different question. So all you guys who are live, feel free to chime in. And this is a safe place. So whether you've been in the NICU for, 48 hours or 35 years, because we have that sort of range definitely in our membership, and who show up to this call, please don't feel like you can't ask a question. We have people from all over the world who are members, and sometimes they're the first therapist in their whole country, even bringing this to their country. And there are a lot of questions to ask about just what is our role and things like that. So please know that this is a safe place to ask any question, and that I won't know all the answers. So I'm very comfortable not knowing all the answers, and I will try to refer you to someone who does if I do not, or when I do not, more likely scenario. Okay, any questions, *9 or chat? I don't see any coming in the chat at the moment. So I'll go on to the next email question, and you guys who are live, please raise your hands if you have questions in the meantime. So next question, one of our neonatal therapists at said hospital completed your program, which I think might mean the IGNITE program just from reading this, but a couple of years ago, and at the time, some of the other team members had learned from those modules. Such a wealth of knowledge. So much of the info resonated with us and helped us change the way we practice here. One of our next steps we're trying to take is to propose a staffing plan to our director to assist with providing appropriate coverage. In one of your modules, there were staffing recommendations of 1 FTE per 25 beds. I was hoping you would be willing to share where that number came from, as we would like to use it as a standard to shoot for. Thanks in advance. So the real question in this is the recommendation for staffing. So the first thing I will say, and just give us a little space on this, but know it's coming, is that we are sort of developing a staffing ratio recommendation that will come from Nance, that is an updated version of this. It is not public yet. It has not been entirely reviewed by the people who need it to be reviewed yet. But I'll just tell you kind of what we're thinking, and how we kind of came, whether to the 21 and 25 or what we're going to recommend, which may be a little bit different than that, and in the direction of actually probably more than the 1 to 25. But a couple things to think about. One of the ways that we're going to describe this in the future, so I want you to get you guys to be thinking of this now, is instead of FTEs per number of beds in your unit, we want you to start thinking of FTEs per average daily census in your unit, because that's what other decisions for staffing are often made from for other professions in the NICU. And so we want to follow suit and have a similar way of articulating that. Because a lot of beds, you might be licensed for 60 beds, 100 beds, 150 beds, but really maybe you're licensed for 100, but your average daily census is 75. those are important differences, because if we staff for beds and then your average daily census is much lower, you may end up being overstaffed, which we don't want, only for the sake of, we don't want it to appear that we're trying to overstaff neonatal therapy in the NICU, right? So I know that's usually the opposite of the problem that you're dealing with. But I just want to say that we want to start thinking in, what is the average daily census of your unit, which your NICU director will know, or the, you know, even the, a lot of the nurses may know that right off the top of their head. So for the year, what's your average daily census? And we're going to base our future recommendations on that number for your unit. So it won't, it, you know, it won't be a formula like it will be, but not by beds. It'll be by average daily census. So what we have taken into consideration are, first of all, working in an integrated model of therapy. So that means that when we make a recommendation in the future, it's not going to be for the type of model where a therapist is somewhere else and they come to the NICU and they see, they kind of cover the NICU and come in, see three patients, and then they go see other people. This is going to be for a truly integrated model, meaning that even if you have other responsibilities in other parts of the hospital, that you have dedicated days and hours that you are in the NICU. And even if you're starting at 2 hours, three times a week, those are still dedicated hours. Meaning that you, the staff knows when you're going to show up, you know when you're going to show up, parents know when you're going to show up, and you have this dedicated days and hours. So starting there, and it includes the fact that to really be an integrated, in this integrated model, eventually, if not already, you will become someone who has other responsibilities in the NICU. You may be part of family meetings. You may be part of daily rounds, maybe every day, maybe three times a week, maybe when it's only patients that are pertinent to you, but in some way, you're part of that conversation and that team and that teamwork that goes around medical rounds, that you are probably involved in committees and other type of what we would consider leadership work. Because therapists who are working in the NICU in that integrated model tend to always become involved in project in improvements and research and in just projects that are that the unit is doing. And so it is a little bit different model than kind of having a list of in other areas maybe of the hospital that is that does not require you to be part of all those different team levels of things and on a daily basis. So consider your average daily census. Consider if you're working in an integrated model. There's a webinar, special topic call on an integrated model somewhere in your hub and what that means. So then we considered, if you're working in an integrated model, you're considering your average daily census, then, you know, how many therapists would you need to manage that many patients? So then we looked at, on average, if say your average daily census is 60 patients, really what is the likelihood that you have a referral on all 60 out of 60? Or what is sort of the average number of patients percentage-wise that we would see? And in most units where there is an integrated model and a team, so far we've said, you know, we see probably 80-90% of the patients on the average daily census. Taking away the kids, the babies that, you know, might come in for a day and leave or, you know, have other things where they come and go or just maybe don't make the list as far as a referral. So we're going to base these recommendations on all of these different components and give you a formula to calculate your FTEs. What I'm going to say for now, so those are some of the things for the person who asked this question. You said, where did the number come from? So the number is going to come from, in before it did come per bed. So one of the change, so the 25 was more based on per beds in the unit, but what we're realizing is that isn't necessarily reflective of the census. And we don't want to understaff or overstaff based on those things. You might have a census that's over, that spikes at a certain time of year. We want to know your average daily census. So we're going to look at that, the model that you're in, and then what's your percentage of referrals you typically get on that average daily census. And then we're going to calculate that from there, because what that does is gives you, breaks it down, what's a manageable caseload, considering all of these things, et cetera. So what I'll say for now, that's how we're getting to the number to answer your question. Right now, it's still sort of out in our world that it's this one FTE per 25 beds. But I can tell you that's going to change a little bit and actually be one FTE per a lower number. I'm not even going to say it out loud yet, but it's going to be based on average daily census, not beds. So in the end, it might kind of be the same, but we're getting there. So this is not something that you're going to have to wait 2 years for. I'm hoping you're waiting a couple months for this at the most. But just to let you know how we're thinking, this is in real time, just being transparent of how we're working on these things on a national level and trying to be consistent with how other professions in the NICU are staffing and how the sort of C-suite, how the leaders in the administration of the hospital are calculating staffing in other realms so that we're kind of trying to follow a consistent model that makes sense to the way they think. So I hope that answers your question for now, meaning that's, you know, how we thought about it before is dividing, you know, the beds by how many patients you would have to see and how many could be on a caseload and how many referrals that you got based on that number, which matters. Okay, and there's some other typed questions coming in or comments, so great. So I think I've wrapped up that question. Danielle, let me know if I did not. And just expect that we will be coming out with some more recommendations soon. And then this question says, or comment, when we are learning a new standardized test, we encourage learning and competency by asking for 75 to 80% inter rater reliability to promote high quality of care. So that's a great comment, meaning that when you were saying that, you know, that maybe that the staff, this is back to question one about the standardized test. So making sure when you said that it's being overused and maybe you're not getting the quality out of it or they're not understanding, this is somebody, I think, just commenting saying this is what they require if they're going to use a new standardized test. So great comment. Thank you. And then another question or comment. I'm wanting to get some mentoring with other therapists working in the NICU and surrounding hospitals. I'm running into trouble because the hospital HR departments are not allowing observers in NICUs. Have you found a way around this or do you have any suggestions? This is a frustrating thing that happens. So great question. And just as far as how to get around this, I think defining for the HR department what observers look like. Because you can imagine if people are coming in and out of the NICU, especially during, you know, flu season and things, they're going to be concerned with that. So what I usually do is start with something that they already approve or that they already know about. So are there students that come in? What kinds of students, nursing students, med students, people who already sort of have this observational role and see if you can work with what those guidelines already are. And then take them down to a level and just work with the HR department and say, hey, you know, what would be reasonable? You know, even if you're trying to do that in another facility, if you could ask them, hey, could you connect me with your HR department and see what would they be comfortable with? You know, do they need your shot record? Do they need to know that you're only going to be there for 1 4-hour shift? Do they need to know that you're already a professional in the healthcare industry and that you already adhere to X policies and you already understand HIPAA? So kind of getting an idea of what is required if they have anybody observing at all in any role, what are those requirements? And could you, in fact, mirror those requirements at some level to come in and observe? I've mostly been able to make that happen in at least in the unit I was in, but it's not, some hospitals do have extremely strict regulations about observation. So I don't have a one size fits all answer except to ask the HR department in what would have to be true so that I could observe for 4 hours, 8 hours in your unit, you know, what would have to be true to make that happen? Or is it just a literal across the board, no one ever observes in this hospital, which I would find difficult to believe, but I did come from a teaching hospital where there were a lot of people observing a lot of things a lot of the time. So that's what I would do. I would start with what they've done already to let people observe and see what you could do to make that happen. Let me know if that makes sense. I don't see any, let me just scroll. Hands raised for a verbal interaction. So I will keep checking those. And again, you can hit *9 if you've come to the call later. You can hit *9 on your phone and it'll raise your hand for me. You can also click on the button that says raise hand if you're on the computer, or type something in the chat window. So any of those are ways you can communicate with me. I will go on to the next email question while I kind of see if you guys are raising hands over here. So let's see, I'm literally doing this. So I'm making sure I've addressed these email questions. So the next one says, my team of 6 therapists, 2 each OTPT speech, are interested in learning the treatment model other therapists are using in the NICU. Our current system is not working for us and we're looking to revamp it. We are interested in how therapists divide patients, make their schedule, share the workload both individually and as a team. Do OT and speech feed? Is speech in the NICU daily or consultative for dysphagia patients? Who attends developmental rounds and weekly discharge meetings? We appreciate any information you can give us, including reaching out to other therapists. So my first question to you guys listening to this call live is there anybody who you love how your team collectively works together and that you would be willing to type in your email address for me to send to this person? These are all NAMP members. So this is nobody outside of our group here. But is there anybody who's listening who would be willing to just kind of give their email address or something to communicate with Holly here about how their team works and that you really love how it works and maybe you guys could connect? So if you're listening and you could type in your email and say, yes, I'd be happy to talk to Holly, that would be awesome, because part of what she's looking for is just other therapists to reach out to. And Holly, if you're listening to this later, I would also suggest putting that in the member forum in the member hub. And maybe there you'll get some feedback there as well, just for somebody who's willing to have a phone call with you or email interaction or something to answer your question. So I can give you just a couple ideas of what I know teams, we do talk to a lot of teams here and what they have done, but no magic answer. This is really what's going to be about what works for your institution. But just some thoughts. So going back to your question, how you divide patients, make a schedule, share the workload individually or as a team? So I think depending on the size of the unit and size of the team, sometimes teams will divide the patients overall, and it depends on really on the FTE and if you have enough coverage and things to do that, where you literally have your own patient caseload per person or per team. So the OTs, the PTs, and the speech therapists, pathologists having their own teams seeing these patients. There's usually overlap, however. And so when there is overlap, and you guys have to decide how that looks, but I'm going to give you some ideas about that. When there's overlap, what does that look like? And I would think about things like, are you seeing the patient the same day? Can you justify that? Are your goals different? Are you having separate assessments? How are you looking at that as a team? And then as far as feeding goes, the feeding, bedside clinical feeding evaluations and feeding is in all 3 scopes of practice. So for OT, PT, and speech. Now, but highly differs by individual person based on their own experience, based on their own education, their continuing education, their own passion for these topics, et cetera. So you may have, I don't want to be cookie cutter. I want you to think about your team and what is the skill set of your team and what has been the continuing education of that team in those topic areas. And then how do you want to divide that up? When, just as a reminder, that as therapists, we still have to have an individual evaluation per discipline, not per person, but per discipline, and that we have to set our own separate goals. So while you have a fabulous team, the OTs are going to have OT goals, PTs going to have PT goals, and speech pathologists going to have speech pathology goals. And my recommendation, about that is this, again, sit down as a team. And there is overlap. I mean, you can take the core scope of practice from NANCH for free off the website and sit down and say, how are we going to think about this as a team? And then what has been helpful, I think, is looking at all the areas that your team covers in your particular kind of hospital or NICU, level 3, level 4, et cetera, and then say, how do we want to talk about these things? Because we could all have like a feeding goal, or we could all have some sort of positioning goal or family education goal. So how do we make them different and unique? And we did that by looking through each of our individual lenses and saying, hey, as an OT, this is how I would look at it. And this is really what I'm trying to get to. And then as a PT, and then as a speech pathologist, and then we made our click goals, like we were talking about before, based on our own unique perspectives. And, that was very helpful so that we had pre-thought about what the differences are, the unique differences that we all bring to the table, recognizing that there is overlap. And so that we can, if we were, if someone came to us and said, why are these two disciplines seeing this patient, that we could really articulate why, what this team and what this profession brought to the table and what this profession brought to the table. So I think those are just good places to start, and sitting down as a team and deciding those is really helpful so that you're all on the same page. There's no weirdness about turf and whatever. You just have a very honest conversation about it. And you said speech in the NICU daily or consultative. And it depends on the roles you've defined in your unit. In many units, the speech pathologist is there all day long as a fully integrated therapist, just like any other, like an OT or a PT. And in some units, it might be a more consultative model. And I think that the bigger the NICU, the more complex the patient, the more likely that person should be fully integrated, no matter the discipline. And the smaller the unit, the less medically complex the patients, those roles might change, and it can be based on your census and acuity and things like that. So main point is sit down as a team, decide what you're covering, decide how you want to talk about it, what you each bring to the table from your unique perspectives. And I'm going to use an adult example because sometimes that helps people clarify what I mean by that. So for example, if you have an adult stroke patient, and all three disciplines are consulted, at any given time, if you walked in a room, you may or may not be able to tell from the outside which discipline is seeing that patient. For example, maybe you're all trying to establish if they're oriented to time and place and kind of some basic cognitive skills, because all three of us would need to know, can the patient follow directions? Are they oriented to themselves, to place, et cetera? So we might all need to do that. And we might all need to have enough education that we understand what their responses mean based on their diagnosis. We might all be looking at how is their posture sitting at the edge of the bed, because that might affect their feeding and swallowing, their cognition, their ADLs, and their mobility. So this is not a new thing. I just want to be clear that there's overlap. So it happens everywhere that there are therapists. And I think we as a specialty need to get good at articulating the differences for other people. And that starts with us kind of hashing it out with our own teams, so that, someone from the outside might not be able to tell when you walk in, patients at the edge of the bed, if that's OT, PT, or speech, but you as an individual therapist would be able to articulate what your goals are in that moment and why. So I hope that helps give a little background for that. And then as far as who attends developmental rounds and weekly discharge meeting, again, I think you have to decide as a team who is doing that. Is it on a rotating basis? Is it an individual profession? You're going to divide up these tasks, and that then you communicate with each other so that it's not, so if one person or one profession, or that it alternates weeks, whoever's in charge of discharge meetings, just that you have a process of communication. So the most important thing is that you guys know what your own process is, and that there's clarity among the team, because then the rest of the NICU team will trust you as far as who is doing what and when, and they'll know the couple point people for this this chunk and this chunk, you know, this meeting, that meeting, they'll know who to go to and they'll know why. So I know that's not an answer, but if people do things differently based on how their unit's made up of team, FTEs, acuity, other responsibilities like clinic and all that. So, so I hope that's helpful. And then, let's see. Oh, and then thank you, Sarah. So, just to let you know, Holly, Sarah, another member, she said, I'd be happy to discuss how our unit divides caseloads. We use a zone system to divide our patient load of 50 to 60 patients each day. And she did give her email. So we'll make sure, Holly, that you guys are connected and you can talk about how Sarah's team does that. So thank you, Sarah, for typing that in. That's awesome. And let me go back to make sure. And by the way, Donna Rubin, I see your hand raised. So I do see you there and I will unmute you in one sec. Let me just make sure I got to these. Okay, so so let me get this one that was typed and then Donna, I'll go to you next. So the next one that was typed was, our NICU therapy team is having a difficult time with one of our team members undermining other therapist recommendations to RN directors. Any suggestions? I'm taking a deep breath because I know how difficult this is. So one of your NICU therapy team members is kind of going, I would assume kind of there's already recommendations made and then this person might be going behind that person and saying, actually, I would recommend this instead, or actually, I would do this. And they're recommending those things to the nurses and the directors. So while this is difficult, what I would do is meet, I don't know how many of you there are on this NICU therapy team, but I would be inclined to have a meeting with all of you and just say, hey, there have been times when you can even generalize it and say there have been times when, you know, one of us, any of us makes a recommendation and then, you know, maybe you're there the next day or one of us is there the next day and you might have a different recommendation or things. But what we're realizing is that when that happens, where the trust that the rest of the NICU team has in us as a specialty starts to erode because we're saying different things at different times. And that if we want to really continue to have an impact in the unit, we have to be on the same page about how we show up. And so we have to communicate well with each other and not be afraid to disagree with each other or to come to each other if we did have a different recommendation. But maybe what our process should be as a team is if one of us in our internal NICU therapy team has a different recommendation than what has been previously recommended, that we come to that lead therapist or whoever made the recommendation in the first place. Our policy or our guideline is for us to internally go to each other first and say, hey, actually, I was thinking about this for this patient, and can we have a conversation about that? And then you decide together if you're making a different recommendation or not. But that going outside the loop and going to the team first does significantly undermine the person who made the recommendation. And it undermines the team as a whole, even the person who is giving the second layer of recommendations. It's undermining them as well, because it's showing that they don't have trust in the team either. And that that you're not being presented as a unified front, and that leads to confusion with people and with staff and parents and everything that we don't want. And so that would be my recommendation, is to call a little private team meeting with just the therapist, bring up the problem as a problem that is going on, and how do you guys as a team want to solve it, and how do you want to develop a system for internal communication with your team so that as a therapy specialty in the NICU, you are presenting a confident and consistent front to the rest of the team. And I see if that, you know, as a first step, will help unite you guys a little bit, kind of take the person, you know, have some accountability to the person that's doing it, but in a way that really supports moving forward instead of being punitive with each other. So if you're still listening, just let me know if that makes sense to you. You can just type me something, or if you have any other thoughts on that, as we go. So, okay, thanks. And then Donna, I'm going to unmute you. Hello, Mr. Rubin.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good. I haven't been listening the entire time, but I just wanted to add a comment on this last topic that you were talking about. I'd say that we have a pretty dysfunctional team. What I have learned is that when there is something that I wish was different, I really have to let it go for that particular baby and that instant. And I really find that bringing it up at our once a month meetings where it is a team and everybody's ears are listening, I feel like is so much, carries us forward so much more than just sort of a couple of individuals squabbling about it. And so, although I feel sad about not really dealing with it at the moment, I feel like for the long term and the bigger picture, that's the way I function.
Well, I think that's really great feedback, and it sort of also presents that more unified front that even if you're, unless it's something that's a safety issue, which obviously you would speak up about, that you're kind of saying, hey, okay, I'll take that back to the team, we'll discuss it or something. You know, that's just a great example of sort of looking at the, going for the long view instead of the short moment, as long as obviously the baby's safe, right?
Right, right. So I'm calling for two questions. One is feeding related, and that is we have a 42-weeker. One twin, the other twin went home, and still having trouble gaining enough weight consistently.
Okay.
And different formulas have been tried, always a little irritable. We've worked with the flow, and that's actually good right now. But he seems to want to take an amount that is small enough that he wakes up every 2 hours instead of every 4 hours. And I asked one of the nurses, is that something that we could do, you know, because it's against our policy. And I got the feedback from her, well, we want them to rest so that their brain develops. And I thought, well, actually, that sounds pretty fair, that rationale. But I wondered, you know, how do other people deal with this?
Okay, so let me make sure I'm putting it all together. So what was his original or her gestational age, and they're now 42 weeks?
Is yeah, now they're 42 weeks. I think they were 28 weeks.
Okay.
Twins.
Okay. And so I would ask first is how are you worried about, is it a boy? Sorry.
Yes, it's a boy.
Okay. Are you worried about his overall development in any other way? Does he seem age appropriate in all other facets, or could any of this be, is he having true feeding problems, I'm wondering, or is it more sort of trying to figure out this now post-term feeding schedule regimen part?
It's a good question. He's always irritable, or very seldom is he calm and self-regulating. So I do think that there could be some kind of feeding issue going on, but I can't go any further with where I am right now in the hospital. Mm-hmm. The kid needs to be discharged so that he can go to a feeding place. But they won't discharge him unless, because I think they're worried that he's just not going to eat enough.
Right. And how much is he eating? Like, do you happen to know out of what they want him to eat, what percentage he's eating by mouth in a day?
Yeah, he was going, he was, I think, at 78%, and then he goes to 80, and then go to 90, and then he'll drop down to 70.
Okay. So, based on that, and not, no, obviously I don't know the kiddo, so this is, take this all within that context, because there could be things that are making him irritable that are not related to feeding. There could be developmental things that are making him, you know, there could be a lot of scenarios here. But if we look at it just from sort of that, okay, he's, when he takes his 70 to 90%, is it with decent quality of feeding, but then he just doesn't take much per feeding?
Yes.
Or enough per feeding. Okay.
Yeah, because so we actually there. Have the quality there, which is amazing in itself.
Yeah, which is great, by the way. Congratulations. Yes, that's no small task. I know it's been an uphill battle for you. So, okay, so if his quality is good and he's 70 to 90% in things, and again, don't take this and then just run with it. This is all within the context of things making sense. Like, he's otherwise stable developmentally. He's not concerning you that he's going to go home and just fall off all of eating because his quality is not good. So all those things. But typically what I would recommend if there was a baby who has good quality feeding, they're post-term, they're taking, you know, high 70% to 90%, and they're this mature, et cetera, is, it means, does he have a tube still then, I guess?
No.
So he's really taking 100%, but it's based on whatever their original volume. He's not taking that volume that they want.
Right. Most recently, yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. So if he doesn't have a tube, is he still on a schedule, like a Q 3-hour feeding schedule?
3 to 4.
3 to 4. Okay. So to your point, if he has no tube, I just feel like he should try to be completely and truly ad lib on demand, meaning he takes whatever he wants, when he wants. If it's after two, mostly it won't be under 2 hours. That just doesn't happen as often as people are afraid it's going to. And he can, you know, if it's 2 hours and he takes whatever, just let him be truly ad lib on demand. So the way I would present it to the team is, since we're trying to get him home, he's otherwise stable, he has no tube, let's pretend he's at home. And let's see if he can be safe there and gain some weight. If we just let him be truly ad lib on demand, which means the ad lib part is the volume and the demand is the time. And so if he wakes up and he's truly showing hunger cues, not just fussy, but showing hunger cues, you know, he's rooting, he's, you know, otherwise hungry, then we feed him and see what he does, because this is exactly what's going to happen. Pretend 3 days later at home, what's the mom, what are the parents going to do?
Right.
And so when their baby wakes up and they cry, they're going to, you know, and he acts hungry, they're going to feed him. And you need to see if he's going to gain weight on a truly ad lib on demand schedule without considering if it's how many kcals per kilo. Just see what he takes on his own and if he gains weight.
Okay, that sounds good. So the argument about, okay, we're not letting him sleep enough for brain development, I guess I see that as, it's different if they're waking themselves up versus we're doing care for them.
Correct. So if he's sleeping and snoozing and he can last 4 hours and sleep, then yeah, I wouldn't wake him up before 4 hours if he's that age baby and otherwise acting, you know, typical. But I wouldn't go longer than 4 hours, because again, if we discharged a baby, we would probably recommend that at home. But yeah, if he's waking himself up, then, and a newborn at home is going to, especially if they're breastfeeding, like be eating every 2 hours or 2 to 3 hours. So if we're waking him up, yes, we're interrupting important sleep. If he's waking himself up, maybe if he got on his own schedule, he would be more self-regulated. He would be, or not, but we got to see before we send him home. I think the danger is sort of trying to get him to a magical place volume wise and then get him out the door, but he really has other problems. and then he'll fail at home. So if we really just see ad lib on demand, what's he going to take? Like, he's at home. Does he gain weight? And I would look at it at 24 hours and at 48 hours, unless he's obviously, you wouldn't let him get dehydrated if he's failing, but it doesn't sound like he's that kind of kiddo because he's taking at least 80% of his, what they wanted him to take in the first place.
Right. Okay.
He might gain weight. Okay. On that and just see what he does. And I would present it like, hey, I mean, this is what we're, let's test him like in a home environment, but in a safe place and see if he can gain weight. Cause as soon as he goes home, the pediatrician is going to see him days later and say, is he gaining weight overall?
Right.
And the mom needs to know what quality feeding looks like and what quality, poor quality feeding looks like in relation to volume, and then see how it affects his weight gain, if that makes sense.
Yes, it does. And I think she has seen both as far as
poor okay.
quality and quality. That's fair. That sounds good. Thank you.
And if he has real, true feeding issues, that's not going to solve the problem. You know, so if he can't quite get there and he, you know, then there might be other things going on. But if sometimes it is just us sticking to the mask for too long and just seeing if he's going to, if he can help himself survive with our support as if he was at home, but do it in a safe place before he leaves.
Okay, that sounds good. Can I ask you another question?
Yes, and then I'll try to get to these other, yes.
Okay.
Ask another question and I think I can get to the rest.
All right. The next one, I wondered if you had a resource for ergonomics in the NICU. I thought it would be, I think the nurses would appreciate, because I'm hearing a lot of aches and pains, if we could do something like that. And I wondered if that's been done and is in your library of resources.
You know, I wrote something on that sometime, I'm thinking. So let me see, because at some point I wrote it at the very least a blog post on it, you know, like a thought of the week in the newsletter type of article on ergonomics in the NICU. It's not something fancy, but it starts to look at those things. But let me see if I can find that one. But I don't know of anything formal. I mean, to answer your question, there could be something I don't know about for sure, but it's something that I thought of a lot because I felt for the nurses as well. And then like when we got new monitors, they put them in the strangest place ever. And the nurses were, it was just horrible, horrible ergonomically. When we got, you know, everybody then had computers and there wasn't space built into the unit for that. So they were in places that were not conducive to anything ergonomic. So I feel your pain and, their pain. And, so let me see what I can find on that. I don't know of any formal article that deals with it in the NICU in specific. But I can at least try to dig that up for you. And it's a great thing, by the way, anyone listening, for someone to really do as a project and publish for all of us, just if you're needing something to do, guys. But it's something we can uniquely bring to the NICU as therapists, is really thinking about how we're doing things at work. There's a little bit of it ergonomically. We did a practice review or a product review of incubators as well. And we have that as a free resource. I could locate for you as well. And there's a little bit of ergonomics in that about just kind of when you're evaluating incubators, like, do they go low enough? There's some ergonomic stuff we've woven into that, that I can see if that is applicable at least in some way. But I think there's a lot of white space is my point that you could fill in should you choose to accept that mission or anyone listening.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure. And I will remute you for now. Is that good?
Yep.
Okay. And let me just see these, because your chat questions are those of you who are live. And if we don't get the email questions, that is okay, you guys. Let's see. I make sure. I'm going to get to the infant-driven one in 1 second, so before we get off the call. And then, the follow-up about the team and the undermining, I believe. Says, in our case, this person does not show up to our meetings. So with a sad face, which is a sad face for real. So what I would say about that is if they're not showing up to your meetings, is who is that person accountable to show up to meetings? So do they have a manager that, and not in a tattletale way, but kind of, again, I would go back and say, hey, what do we require of people who are on a team in the NICU? And is one of those things attending team meetings? Can we start, you know, kind of moving the needle back and saying, where does this, that's a great point, by the way, because it starts to show where all of the gaps are in this person's communication or in the team communication overall. So I would see if you can make that, you know, something that is just required of your team in the NICU, and then that person can need to be part of it. So we have a few minutes left. I have just a couple email questions left. I think but let me get to this other one first that was live. I don't see any other actual hands raised. So this one says, and I don't know your name because it comes across as a number or a letter in numbers, because I received information that infant-driven feeding was bought by Dr. Brown's company. More details, question mark. So yes, that is true. That was publicly announced only yesterday. So you are on top of the on the news there. Whoever wrote this in, again, sorry, I don't know what your name is by this. And so more details, I don't know what you want to know, but I'm happy to answer any specific questions if you want to type them in. I can at least say that, you know, they have no, Dr. Brown's is not interested in, you know, changing the content or doing, you know, they're going to run this as is for quite a while and get used to it and be kind of have their own team become more educated in infant-driven feeding and being able to support what is already happening. So if you're kind of midway and just looking into purchasing the course for your unit or doing something like that, that shouldn't change anything. So just kind of rest assured, something's not going to change on a dime about the course or anything like that, or the availability or anything like that. They really, and I will just say, and this is only for me as a human being, I'm not representing Cara Ann here or the company or anything. I'm just going to tell you as a human being, me, you know, that part of why this is happy news for us is because we obviously, Nant is my full-time gig and Cara Ann, you know, has a company as well. And so we knew that someone other than us would have more time and resources to really grow the ability to reach more babies, families, and staff with the model of infant-driven feeding than we could give it time for. And that we had kind of reached our plateau and what we could give to that within knowing that Nance is my number one priority and that her other work is her number one priority. And we also didn't want it to go away because of that. So we felt like that model and what we had built for that was something that we wanted to see go on. And so that is what we're excited, that among other things is what we're excited about, that they will have the resources to, you know, there's so many things people wanted that we couldn't deliver, you know, bandwidth wise, you know, parent things and refresher courses and stuff like that. And things that are exciting to think about what that could become for everyone, that we did not have the bandwidth for. So I hope that gives a little insight into that, but please type in if there's something specific you wanna ask me. I'm not trying to be vague. I just, whatever you wanna ask me, go ahead and ask me and I will answer. But hopefully that gives you a little info. And I'll let you think about that if you have some more specific questions. Any of you, you can type them in there or ask me. And then the last two will, I'll go ahead with the emailed. Thanks for all your information. On a previous call, there was a discussion concerning providing containment and holding of a baby during gavage feeding. Is there a specific gestational or weight criteria for this? And how do you, okay, and then there's other questions, there's three questions. So So the as far as holding a baby during a VAJ feed, and is there a gestational age or weight criteria? So I just want to define what holding means for this. So holding could look like having just that hand hug where you're providing containment with a more fragile infant who's in an incubator, and you're providing that containment during a gavage feeding. That's, to me, if the parent isn't there and can't be the person doing it, or if the parent isn't there and could be doing skin to skin, that those would both be my first, of course, preference, is the parent engaging in this way. If the parent is not there, then the priority is really that we're making feeding a human experience and not a task. So even from a small, fragile infant of any age, to answer your question, we have to know how to do that well. So we have to understand how to work with babies that are small and fragile before we go and do this. So just want to say that. But if in fact that's something you, I have no idea, your training, your years of experience, et cetera, but if you are able to do that, providing that containment at any gestational age that makes sense, and that nursing is on board, et cetera, and that somebody is providing just a human touch for some part or of a gavage feeding, holding if able, parents skin to skin first, parents doing the holding if able. Again, we're trying to pattern this baby system to say feeding is something that I get human interaction, and feeding is a nurturing experience, because we don't want the first experiences with feeding being nurturing and connected to a human to be breast or bottle feeding. Should start way before then, if they're of that age, to start earlier, so that we can help pattern this from the very beginning. I always just say that it's not biologically normal for a baby to be fed in isolation. You know, it's just not normal. So how can we make that a little bit more normal by providing some human nurturing experience? So again, no specific gestational age or weight. It's more on what the practice is. Are the people doing that well-oriented and informed enough to provide the appropriate interaction during those times? And, you know, it might look like, you know, you're in there doing two-person care with a nurse, and then the baby is going to be gavage fed, and maybe you get to stay there for providing that human interaction and human, again, touch, not distraction, not something, but just that containment or something for another 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes until the feeding's finished, whatever you're able to do. Or if you're able to hold in a little bit older, more stable infant during that gavage feed, again, you're helping patterning that brain that says feeding is a nurturing human interaction. So I hope that helps a little bit. How do you support the baby who is resistant to left side lying or midline, even when you've tried towels or other things? Have you observed a baby who just busts out of the supportive positioning? So yes, you know, they're tricky. So babies are supposed to move, and we don't want baby, you know, it would be a bad thing to see zero movement. And so what we want to do, though, is provide enough boundaries that they can move within those boundaries, move, stretch, bust out, and then come back into the boundary. If some positioning products help with that more than others, I think. But in general, you know, if there's a baby resistant, you know, it's just why to me. It's observing them and saying, is this discomfort? Is this that they have a lot of tone? Do they not have tone? You know, why are they sort of quote busting out? Are they irritable? Are they in pain? What are our observations of why that's happening? That's the most important question that I would be asking. And then, yeah, we have to help them not just in one part of their body, but at all levels have supportive positioning so that we can help them, you know, stay relatively positioned, especially for sleep, and comfortable. But again, not trying to make them immobile, because that would not be typical either. So I'd address it by asking why first, then going to what are the products and the ways that we are positioning them that support them staying comfortable in that position. And then it's just normal. If they bust out, we go tuck them back in. I'm going to move just to this in the interest of time, because I do have somewhere to physically run today. Can a baby in the NICU benefit from therapy, containment, hand hugs, et cetera, while they're sleeping? Would you reposition them if needed, or just let them sleep and do not disturb? Many of the babies are sleeping when we come to the bedside, and thus we do not get to see them. So to pick that apart a little bit, I would, if I come up to a bedside and a baby is sleeping and they are not about to be woken up by the nurse or the parent for regular care, I would not wake them up for any kind of therapy. So again, we'd be interrupting brain development and sleep if we're doing that. So what the best way to think about that is to know the nurse's schedules, the care schedules, like the back of your hand. Try to schedule as best you can all day long with when the baby is going to have care done anyway. And then partner with the nurses and communicate with them about what your roles are and what you can be doing both during two-person care and in addition to what you're going to be observing while you're there, et cetera, and what your assessments would be. And as far as repositioning them, if you find a sleeping baby that's all out of position, as long as they're comfortable and stable, I would leave them alone. If they look uncomfortable or unstable, then I would intervene. So that's what I would do there. So hope that answers your question. And thanks for responding, the person who has the IDF question. He said, I'm excited to see where they take it. Thanks for all your hard work. So I appreciate that. You know, it's all really for the right reasons. So hopefully we're very confident that that will go well, and appreciate you asking. Okay, guys, we did good. So it's a little after, but thanks for hanging in there, and your questions and your feedback for each other have been great. And we will get the one email to the person who wanted that information. And thanks for being present, guys. The recording of this will be in Member Hub after, you know, the team kind of produces it and works with it. And so if you need to re-listen to anything, that will be there. Thanks for being here. And I hope you guys have a great rest of your day. You're doing amazing work out in the world. And the fact that you're asking questions is fantastic. So thanks for being here and for everything you do every day. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.